Scotch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films, Dune Part 2, and a look back at the first part of Dune, and the original Dune from 1984, Hardware Wars, and Super Fuzz. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the Trailer Park, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Next Goal Wins. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Mastodon or Blue Sky, you can reach me at Kevin Carr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Bob Marley, One Love, took the top last week. Demon Slayer came in number two. Those were the ones that actually did well. Ordinary Angels had a kind of a soft opening, especially for the faith-based crowd, and that might have been because the faith element, as I talked about last week, sort of like sidelined a little bit. It was just over $6 million, and then Madam Web dropped terribly, and Driveaway Dolls did not do well at all, less than $2.5 million. So I don't want to talk too much more about the box office. I actually want to respond to an email I got from a listener called Peter. And this is what he said. He goes, I had the misfortune of catching a few minutes of your radio show today before I turned it off. That's always a great way to start. You might have more listeners if you kept your leftist opinions about X, formerly Twitter, Elon Musk, et al., out of your radio show. And then he says, I'm no business genius, but I was always under the impression that success in business is about addition, not subtraction. Yes, I don't know what that means. Business don't always add. If you add too much to a business, it falls apart sometimes. That's not a tenet of business at all. So let's just ignore that last statement because, again, it makes no sense. And so I'm going to play you a portion of the show that I apparently is when I talked about Elon Musk and his social media platform. And it was in the beginning of my discussion about True Detective Night Country. Now, this clip's about 90 seconds, and I did take a little bit out from the middle because there's something I kind of go off on a tangent about Madam Web, but that's not about the general gist of what I was saying. So I want to play that for you now. Most of the stories that I was seeing about it were not actually about the show. It was about this weird backlash, this weird sort of incel backlash that you get online. Because here's the thing. The best way to get noticed on the internet is to be extreme and insulting. Nobody wants a balanced opinion on the internet. Nobody wants a mitigating force in the internet. They go for the extremes. The videos on YouTube you get, the more obnoxious and mean-spirited and outraged you are, the more the views are. And then with some of the changes, for example, on Twitter, which I refuse to call the other thing, because of the changes that the current guy who runs that site has done, just promotes this. It promotes mean-spirited interactions. That's the problem. And so there's a bunch of people that went bonkers about True Detective Night Country because, I guess because it was about women. Why is that a problem? Why is that offensive? It's a show that has women. Why is that suddenly so out there as an idea to do? I mean, you've got like Jodie Foster. She's an Academy Award winning actor. She is great in this. Because there is that toxic masculinity out there that just wants to grind us into the dirt because it gets clicks. So don't give them oxygen. Where was I political? I don't know where it became leftist. Since when did making female characters dynamic, when was that? When did I miss the memo on when that was suddenly a leftist thing? I talk about the internet being caustic, which it is. Again, I don't see where that's I use terms like toxic masculinity and incels, but yeah, those people are the extreme. And my point was that the internet gives those people a platform globally when there just would normally be some sorry dude sitting in his mom's basement. But here's the thing. How was my comment about Elon Musk political at all? There's no politics involved. He's a moron. Elon Musk is an imbecile. Elon Musk is a whiny man-child who inherited his wealth and then purchases companies that did the work first. Elon Musk, 10 years ago, had a great image. He was seen as a scientist and this innovator, and you know, he's doing SpaceX, and well, this is what a billionaire should be. And then he destroyed his image over the last 5 years. Started off when he did a podcast with, he started smoking dope in the podcast like he was some 13-year-old who found his big brother's stash, and you're watching him and going, oh, maybe he's not as smart as I thought, or maybe he's not as put together. And then he made this highball public offer about Twitter that was an actual offer, and he couldn't back out of it. So he was forced to pay $44 billion for the Twitter platform. And then he went ahead and ran the business into the ground. He fired a whole bunch of people. He thought he could do it better. Then it got broken, and he had to have people coming back. The business is worth a fraction of its original value. Now, I'm no business genius, but taking a company that's $44 billion and turning it into something that's worth like two, that's not good business. And then he did this blanket reinstatement of accounts that have been banned for abuse and violence and other content, including like white supremacy and racism. Since when is being against white supremacists and racist a leftist view? And then he boosted all those voices by destroying the verified system. It used to be that you had that blue check mark, and being verified actually meant something. That meant if you were talking to somebody, you were talking to that exact person. And all he did was just say, oh, anybody with $8 a month can get it. And showed that everybody was like, you could do parody accounts. There's no security to this. There is no authenticity. Nobody's actually really verified. What that does is now pushes all those hateful comments to the top. And then when all the advertisers fled Twitter for those reasons, he goes on an interview and he tells them to go F themselves. I'm no business genius, but it seems that it's a bad idea to go tell your potential advertisers to go F themselves. You call yourself a free speech absolutist, but you don't even understand what free speech means. You're that dumb. It's about the government controlling speech. Private platforms and private companies can and often do already have rules of conduct. You have the right to say whatever stupid things you want to say. Nobody's stopping that. But people don't have to listen, and people don't have to give you a platform. And your free speech does not make you immune from consequences. That's how free speech works. So yes, Elon Musk is a moron. That's a reality of him. And there's nothing left or right about that. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one is The Watchers, which is in theaters on June 7th.
What is this place? Who are you?
We're just like you, lost.
They come every night. They watch us until the sun rises again. It's a window on the other side.
Be very interested in someone new.
Don't you want to know what they are?
This is directed by M. Night Shyamalan's daughter, who worked on The Servant with him. So it'll be interesting to see how different their styles are. He's still a producer. The next one I want to play is The Bike Riders, which comes to theaters on June 21st.
I'm thinking of starting a riding club.
Why? All those clubs do is sit around talking about motorcycles.
That's what we do. When I was a boy, I had a
mind of my own. You don't belong nowhere else, so we belong together.
But you're the man in charge.
I'm Johnny. We're the Vandals.
Your boyfriends are getting into trouble.
No, son, I saw you scoring off of them guys.
I'm not a big fan of the director, Jeff Nichols. He did stuff like Take Shelter. I've always found his stuff kind of underwhelming. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to do a double Dune with Dune from 1984 and 2021. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into our big Dune episode. This is going to cover a couple Dune things. The first thing I want to do is I'm going to talk about the original Dune from 1984, which was directed by David Lynch. And then I went back and I revisited Denis Villeneuve's first half of his Dune movie. I want to start off with Dune from 1984. David Lynch adapts Frank Herbert's bizarre sci-fi novel about warring families seeking control of spice tied to a single planet.
You are about to enter a world where the unexpected.
Many dangers exist on Arrakis.
The unknown.
An incredible secret has been kept on this planet.
And the unbelievable meet.
I see two great houses.
Where kingdoms are built on earth that moves.
And we have worm sign, the likes of which even God has never seen.
I have always loved this version of Dune. And one of the things that I adore about people trying to revisit Dune, and there have been a lot of revisiting of Dune over the last 15 years or so, because you had that movie Jodorowsky's Dune, which maligns David Lynch's version. I'm like, no, okay, it wasn't what Jodorowsky was thinking. But don't say that Dune from the 80s is a terrible movie, because it's not. It's a brilliant film. Because here's the thing. A lot of people forget what films were like in the 80s. People think back to the Star Wars movies. Well, the Star Wars was top tier. You know, like the superhero movies from the early to mid 80s. You're talking about, you know, like Superman from the 70s and 80s and when he did Superman 2. Those were top tier movies. There was a lot of effects that you just couldn't do on a grand scale. We didn't have digital technology back then. They were just starting to toy around with computer generated imagery. But this was all had to be done practical with old school effects. And one of the things I love the most about this, I mean, the story's the story, and I think it's preserved between the different versions of it. But I thought that the visionary style of this, you really felt like you were watching people who were from other planets. It didn't look like, this is one of my issues with Denis Villeneuve's version of Dune, is he sometimes makes it like the Fremen in the desert people, it makes it look very Earth-based. You know, they have cultures, they have statements and accents and the way they look and the way they dress. It looks like you just said, okay, we're not even going to pretend that these are not desert societies from Earth. We're just going to make it that version of them and put them in still suits, but they're going to wear and they're going to look exactly like this. And what was so brilliant about David Lynch's version, everything was so just, it was out there and bizarre and strange. And one of the things that I've said this before about the Lynch version, it's like he brought this to the producers, the De Laurentiis. And they're like, no. No, David Lynch, who directed Eraserhead, I want something weirder. And you watch this movie and so many strange things are happening. And it defies explanation at times. And you're like watching stuff with the Harkonnens and you're like, what's going on with the cat? And when you first see the Harkonnens, people have their eyes sewn shut and their ears sewn shut. And they got these weird tubes coming out of it. And you're like, what is that? I don't know. But it's twisted and bizarre, which is why I've always said that kind of made Denis Villeneuve's version, they still seemed a little mundane. But that's what I love about Lynch's version. It's so out there. And yeah, it tries to tackle the whole story and it changes some things. And I think at the end, he kind of gives a big F you to the studio system because he's like, I'm going to screw up the ending so you can't do another movie. You know, but I mean, this is completely bonkers and at the same time, absolutely visionary. It's imperfect, but it's a glorious and unique film unlike any you've ever seen. I have and always will say David Lynch's Dune totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. This time I'm going to be looking at Dune from 2021. This has been a long checkered past because it was ready to come out and then we were in the middle of COVID and Warner Brothers had already said that they're going to release everything on Max that year. And Denis Villeneuve pitched a fit. And so they did a theatrical release, and it actually did quite well. The first Dune from 2021, even with it being on Max at home, because people wanted to go to the theater at that point. People wanted to experience the big movie. So it doesn't have a great box office, because it's that asterisk from COVID, and it's that asterisk because it was a hybrid release. But it was still a big hit, and it got nominated, and it won some Oscars too. In Dune from 2021, Denis Villeneuve directs the first part of this ambitious story about two families fighting for control of a planet rich in essential resources.
We are House Atreides. There is no call we do not answer. There is no faith that we betray.
Smile, Gurney.
I am smiling.
The Emperor asks us to bring peace to Arrakis. House Atreides accepts!
You need to be ready. We've never met Harkonnens before. They're not human, they're brutal.
This is I, Dune. Kill them all.
I made a point to rewatch this before I went to my press screening of Dune Part 2. And it makes me feel good that when I go back and revisit a movie, when I'm like, no, my original take on this was accurate. I wasn't a huge fan of this. And part of it is it takes a lot for me to untangle my emotions and feelings out of the David Lynch version, because I love that one so much. But one of the things that I had an issue with this first part of Dune, aside from the fact that they split it in two, because you get half a story. That's one of my biggest problems with this. It's half a story. And it's just all set up. I mean, yeah, you got the Harkonnen attack and all that kind of, yeah. But I mean, this is sort of like if you did Star Wars and you never got Luke off of Tatooine. And so the entirety of the movie, he was this whiny little kid who was more worried about Tashi Station and its power converters. And that's kind of the way Paul is. And that's not a fault of Timothée Chalamet. It's just, that's the character up to that point. It's not Paul's movie until later. Really, it's Jessica's movie. And Rebecca Ferguson knocks that out of the park, but I think it was a mistake for Villeneuve to not make this fully Jessica's movie, to not make it in her point of view. If you're going to split it up, you should do that. But I felt it was at times uninspired, actually. It was still just desert. I mean, oh yeah, they had cool helicopters and stuff, but it didn't matter what planet you were on. It was all, they all looked the same. They all were sort of monochromatic. Yeah, one had rain and the other one has sand. I don't know what the heck that is that they got on Giddy Prime, but it still felt like all the sets were built from the same planet. And that's one of the things I loved about David Lynch's version, is you took one look at any scene, you knew exactly what planet you were on because of the design. And so I just felt this was monochromatic and monotoned. So I wasn't a huge fan, but I mean, it's good, but it really just serves as a setup. So it's an incomplete movie. And that's why I hate these things where they split it in half. But I'm still going to say it kind of rocks, especially to see what comes next.
It kind of rocks.
And that means coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, we're going to be talking about Dune Part 2. And a little bit of Hardware Wars later. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the Dune theme. And let's talk about Dune Part 2. That's the big movie this weekend. Denis Villeneuve wraps up the classic Frank Herbert novel showing Paul Atreides' journey to try and become the Messiah of Arrakis.
In the shadows of Arrakis lie many secrets. But the darkest of them all may remain. The end of House Atreides.
My father didn't believe in revenge.
What if Paul Atreides were still alive?
Have you ever had a dream about your first ride?
I can't say I was super excited to see Dune Part 2 because I really was underwhelmed by the first movie. But I will say this. I actually had to drive to Cleveland to go see this one. And I'm glad I did because it completes it. You know, if this were just a 5-hour movie, I think it would have been better. And I think you could have trimmed it down to maybe 4 hours. But, you know, a lot of people don't like to release 4-hour movies. But what's interesting about this is most of my complaints from the first part of Dune are taken care of in this movie. Now, I don't know if it was Denis Villeneuve listening to some criticism people had. Like, I don't know if other people mirrored what I said about all the planets kind of looking the same. It's just they were slightly different. In this one, he does a really solid attempt. It's not perfect, but he does a really good attempt at showing the differences between the planets. In particular, because a good chunk of it takes place on Arrakis, and a good chunk of it, or parts of it, take place on Giddy Prime, which is where the Harkonnens are from. I mean, Giddy Prime looks very different. There were just only a handful of shots in the first movie, but in this one, they have some scenes that take place in there. One of the things that's also kind of neat about this shows the manipulation that the Bene Gesserit sisterhood is doing. And that's very interesting because it's laying all these plans and this intricate political web and how they and the guild control the worlds and actually manipulate these houses. It goes weirder for the Harkonnens. You see them as a twisted, strange people. Again, not as completely bonkers as David Lynch, but at least we get a little bit more of a taste to it. Although I don't think they're all that... They're not very creative about their craziness. They're just awful people. And, yeah, I mean, Austin Butler as Fayed Rilutha, I mean, you know, he was fine. I people are gushing over him, and I mean, I don't know. He plays crazy, but I don't feel like there's any real depth to that character, and there never was, even when Sting played him in David Lynch's. And they actually, in the book itself, they give a little more depth because he gets his own scenes, but... He's still sort of just a crazy man. But they complete a story. And there's growth. Paul's character changes. You know how I said the first movie was really Jessica's movie. She's the one who went through the changes. And she's the one who went through the emotional arcs. Here he does. And you've got Zendaya playing Shani, who's his lover. His sort of girlfriend when he's in the Fremen community. And she... interacts with him. So she was just in the first movie. She was just this pretty figure that he'd see wandering in the sand in his visions. They have a little bit of her at the very, very end of the film. But here you actually get some development and some characterization. And she's very good at giving a level of vulnerability. That's when she comes across best. When she's sort of the model. Yeah, save that for the red carpet. But when she's vulnerable, when she's a normal kind of person, she really can click into that, and that's her strength. That's why she's so good as MJ in the Spider-Man movies with Tom Holland. So, I mean, her character is much better. Stilgar, who's the leader of the Fremen, his character is much better. You get to see his depth and his range and his emotion. And this also juggles, one of the things is this has gotten the original Dune and just the story itself. It does play as a white savior movie. A bunch of people in the desert can't get it until the white guy shows up, and then he's going to be the savior. And that's a common complaint. And it's not that Villeneuve removes that, but he mitigates that. He shows that Paul doesn't want to be the Messiah, and he's not even trying to be. That's being thrust upon him. And he doesn't even believe in himself in a lot of ways. He's just doing what he has to do in order to achieve an end goal of power and revenge. This plays around with a lot of things that, you know, would otherwise be triggered. I mean, especially like terrorism elements and desert politics, that it's pretty clear the comparisons they're making between spice and oil and Arrakis and, you know, the Middle East. I mean, it's very obvious. It's not well veiled. But I think he manages that better. It works better. The pacing's better because there's more of a story. Like I said, the first film was all set up. It does run a little long. It still takes its time. It breathes a little bit too much. But I mean, I think it's a good job. It's a vast improvement on the first part with a complete story and epic scope. That's the other. It is a big screen movie. There's scenes in there that look great on a huge screen. The sandworm stuff is very impressive, and the battle sequences work, and the vastness of the desert and the scope of the cinematography, that stuff's really, really good. And so, yeah, this is a very good movie. It's definitely worth seeing. It's much better than the first one, so I'm going to have to say Dune Part 2 totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. I wanted to talk about this because I saw this actually got a recent Blu-ray release, which to me is silly because, I mean, it's not a high-def type movie. And that is Hardware Wars. I think it was about a month ago that they dropped it on Blu-ray. And there have been multiple versions of Hardware Wars that's come out over the years. It's not hard to find. You can find it streaming. I think it's on Tubi. I think you can find it on Tubi. I think you can find it on Prime. You probably find it all over the place on YouTube. This contemporaneous spoof of the original Star Wars uses low-budget gadgetry and silliness to parody the groundbreaking space opera.
Hardware Wars. A spectacle light years ahead of its time.
Party Deco, where are you?
Hardware Wars. You'll laugh. You'll cry. You'll kiss $3 goodbye. Coming soon to a theater near you. Get in line now. May the farce be with you.
There have always been parodies and joke movies. I mean, Mel Brooks goes all the way back to parodying. I mean, even the stuff like Get Smart was a parody of James Bond. So parody and parody films predated Hardware Wars. It was nothing new. But this was the first one that did it very well for Star Wars. You got to remember, this is, you know, 1978, I think, is when this came out. So it was well before the internet, well before any sort of digital video was available. They shot this thing, they edited it, and they made it on like a 16 millimeter reel. And it got distributed, it got shown at festivals and stuff like that. And I remember hearing about it when I was a kid, because I was, you know, I was all about Star Wars. They had a 16 millimeter version of it at the library, and we'd go watch it there. It's a very funny film. It's only like 13, 15 minutes. It's pretty short, but it nails the jokes. And what's so authentic about it is it feels contemporaneous to Star Wars, because one of the things George Lucas did with the original Star Wars is he didn't want it to look slick. This was in a world where a war had been going on for years. And so there's resources and elements and things and ships and technology was under attrition. So you kept your stuff working as best you can. So it looked very used, and it was clunky, and it had a sort of found item look to it. And so Hardware Wars, it made it look that way. And that played into its authentic feel of the 70s. As a kid, I loved it, and I try and watch it as many times as I could. It was always just so short, but it just was brilliant, because you had, you know, you couldn't just make these 5-hour videos deconstructing a movie. You had only so much time on actual film. So, I mean, it's easily the best Star Wars spoof ever made in this galaxy or any other. I'm going to say Hardware Wars totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about a couple older films. One of them is pretty old, Super Fuzz, and the other one is in the Home Cinema Roundup, not too old, featuring Mexico Wings. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up the movie reviews, and I want to talk about what I've been wanting to talk about this one for the better part of a year. But let me just go ahead and play. I'm going to give you the insane premise, play the trailer, and then we'll talk about it. And the movie is Super Fuzz. It's also been known as Super Snooper. And that's usually, if you're going to find it online, that's where you're going to find it. I believe, again, this is, I think, on Tubi. It's on Prime or Freevee or something like that. In Super Fuzz, a 40-year-old Italian police rookie in Miami gets superpowers and targets a local crime boss with the help of his partner, Ernest Borgnine. Yes, that is the plot of the movie.
He wasn't much of a rookie in his class.
but he did die in the line of duty, trying to collect on a traffic violation.
What? You're
floating.
Now tell me you don't believe he has superpowers. So,
he's a super scooper, really super trooper. A wonder combo, one like you never saw. He's a super scooper, really super trooper.
This is, it's an Italian film. It's, the character's really not Ernest Borgnine. That's the big American star they got for this movie. So it's this Italian production that shot it in Miami with an Italian star. It's not like they went and got Burt Reynolds to be in the movie. Like this came out, I think, in 1980. And the guy who stars in, his name's Terrence Hill. He's an Italian guy, and he's like 40. He's like 38, 39 or so when he did this movie, but they're like, oh, he's the rookie. Maybe that's why they got Ernest Borgnine, because Ernest Borgnine makes anyone look young. So the story is he goes out to this area where he's like trying to collect on a parking ticket. It's a Native American section, and it's in Florida. But they've cleared it because apparently the NASA is doing some sort of launch of a bomb or something like that, but he didn't realize it, and so he ends up getting showered in this radiation, and it gives him superpowers. And when I say superpowers, it's everything. Precognition, and he has super speed, he has super strength, he can fly or float, he can control things with his mind. I mean, it's like everything. It's like there is no superpower that doesn't exist for him. But when he sees the color red, it throws him off, and then he loses his powers, and that's sort of his kryptonite, the color red. It's not that red's terribly uncommon, but, you know, there you go. And it's this very strange view of what an American police story would be, because it's made by Italians. And, I mean, the Italians, they're all, they dress in what they think Miami gangsters would look like. And it's a silly movie. It's meant to be a kid's movie. And it was played in heavy rotation on, like, HBO in the 80s. I actually saw it in the theaters. In the 1980, my mom or dad took me and my sister to go see this. And I thought it was a lot of fun. And I never heard of the movie again. I think I was like up in Cleveland at my grandparents' house sometime later in the 80s. I remember seeing the ad for it on like the, they used to have these stations that would scramble. Like they'd broadcast movies like HBO or something, but you'd have to get a descrambler. And if you turned to that station, it was all like whopper jawed and it was distorted, but I remember seeing clips when I passed by that, because you sometimes would click on that station and there'd be nudity, but I click on that and I just saw an ad for Super Fuzz, and I'm like, I'd always wanted to see it again because I liked it as a kid. Now, I mean, I was like 9 when it came out, so don't judge me for having bad taste. And I ended up finding it a couple years ago. I think it was probably on Amazon Prime, but they just had the Italian version of it. So it was subtitled, except everything that Ernest Borgnine said was English. It's a bizarre movie. It's sort of like the spaghetti western of cop movies, only without the quality that you got with the Sergio Leone stuff. But it's silly and it's fun, but it's so strange because it is this Italian version of what they think American culture is. I mean, as a superhero, he walks around with sort of this cowboy hat and cowboy boots in Miami, Florida. And I'm like, I mean, I understand if you were like in Oklahoma or something like that, or heck, even if you were in Texas, that would make sense. But Florida is a different kind of South than the Southwest. I mean, the cowboy boots motif, that's a different area of the country. But, you know, the Italians are just like, oh, it's all America. But this is fun. This is silly. It's not meant to be taken seriously. It's really just kind of a kid's movie, even though, you know, the superhero's like 40. Anyways, I mean, it's a bizarre American police story told through the whimsical Italian lens, but it's full of early 80s nostalgia and childish slapstick. If you've seen movies from that era, it feels authentically of that era. There was that time. It wasn't an 80s movie yet. I mean, it wasn't like mid-80s or anything like that. There was that stuff being made in 1978 to like 1981 or two, had this unique sort of turn of the decade feel to it. And this one absolutely feels like that. I loved it. I thought it was kind of fun. And it was nice to revisit. It kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. The spotlight this week is on a movie that hit Hulu a week or two ago, and that is Next Goal Wins. I never saw this in its release because it didn't get great reviews, and whenever it came out, it was in the midst of a bunch of other things I was shuffling around, so I never got it, and I didn't get it screened, so I didn't get a chance to cover it. And then with a 40-some percent Rotten Tomatoes score, it never kind of raised itself into anyone caring about it during award season. But I wanted to check it out because it's directed by Taika Waititi, and I like his stuff in spite of there's this weird backlash going on against him. But let's just talk about this one. Taika Waititi directs this mostly true story of the American Samoa soccer team getting a new coach to score one goal, only one goal, sometime. On the pitch.
We haven't scored one goal in the history of our country trying to have a soccer team.
Goal! They scored again. Humiliation.
Mark my words. Things are going to change. I got us a new coach.
It's safe to say you have zero talent or understanding of the game.
What we want is just one goal. One goal.
Come on, guys!
We've worked too long and hard for this.
You've only been here a few days.
It stars Michael Fassbender as the European football coach who is sent to America Samoa to help this team out. Because it starts off with that team's horrible record. They lose to the Australians one year, like 30-some to nothing, which is an astronomical score for soccer. I mean, it is not uncommon to see a soccer match have a score of 1-0. or 2-1. But if you get into double digits, it's a high scoring game. So they got just completely destroyed and they're trying to get things back together. And Michael Fassbender plays a coach who's doesn't deal well with people. And so he's basically getting sent there for the end of his career. But he then, you know, kind of turns around this little ragtag group of players. And, you know, it's a basic inspirational sports story. There's a real charm to it. I will say that. It's awkwardly paced, and it's not well put together. It really feels like the script was rushed. And, you know, here's another problem with this, because it's supposed to be uplifting, and it's the ragtag group of underdogs that a unlikely coach helps them out. Making a movie like this in the shadow of Ted Lasso is very, very difficult, because that's basically what Ted Lasso was. He was a complete fish out of water coach brought to coach a soccer team, football team that's not doing well. And it's all about positive thinking and being good to each other. And it's an uplifting message to Ted Lasso. And this goes for the same thing, but there's times in this where you're like, well, this is just Ted Lasso on a different island because Ted Lasso takes place in the British Isles. I mean, it has the same story, but Ted Lasso does it better. This one, at times, it kind of falls into the cliche of the coach and why he's having problems and why he's struggling and what he has to overcome. And there's a lot of characters on this team, and they focus on one or two of them, but it still gets spread a little thin. I still enjoyed it. I think people are being overly harsh. I know there's a huge backlash against Taika Waititi because he got too popular too fast. And then there are people out there who, I don't want to be branded as a leftist. But there are some people who don't like what he did with the Marvel movies. And so they've launched into this toxic discourse online. So yeah, there's a strange, sort of inexplicable pushback to him. But I think he does a fine job. This doesn't have the same charges as earlier stuff, like, you know, Hunt for the Wilder People. But I thought it was fun. I mean, it's imperfect, and it struggles to make a splash in the wake of Ted Lasso, but it's still a sweet, uplifting ride. I'm going to say Next Goal Win kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
And that's it. I need to go. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Kung Fu Panda 4 and Imaginary. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.